welcome once again to our series, Salvation History. The Old Testament, the story of creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, your host, and our guest again is Ron J. Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High, religion and history and even many other things. Ron, welcome back to our program, and we have covered creation and the fall, and we're really at the beginning of redemption, which is the covenant with Adam that God has made. So could we start with that original covenant that God made in the Old Testament?
Yes, that's a good place to start. After Adam and Eve had sinned, they fell from God's and fallen from God's grace. He didn't abandon them. In fact, he makes a covenant with them, essentially a sacred agreement with the entire human race, because Adam, of course, was representing, and Eve were representing the entire human race. And a covenant, it's a sacred agreement between God and man. And of this covenant, the Catechism says, quote, on the contrary, God calls him, that is Adam, and in a mysterious way heralds the coming victory over evil and his restoration from his fall. This passage in Genesis is called the Proto-Evangelium, or First Gospel, the first announcement of the Messiah and Redeemer, of a battle between the serpent and the woman, and the final victory of a descendant of hers. End of quote. The Proto-Evangelion, that's the Latin, and I think in Greek it's Evangelion, I-O-N, instead of I-U-M. The Proto-Evangelium, or First Gospel, that's literally what it means, First Gospel, is God's promise to Adam and Eve of a Redeemer after the fall. When speaking to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, who had just successfully tempted them, God said, quote, the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle, and above all wild animals. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This is found in Genesis 3, 14 through 15, a very famous citation from
Genesis 3:15, and of course it's translated many ways. Sometimes he shall crush your head, wound your head, so it depends on what translation,
yes.
But it all basically means the same thing, that the good news is that somebody will come, the child of the woman, who will destroy the power of the serpent.
According to the Catechism, which is the official word of the Catholic Church on doctrinal matters, quote, the Christian tradition sees in this passage an announcement of the new Adam, who, because he became obedient unto death, even death on a cross, makes amends superabundantly for the disobedience of Adam. They're quoting St. Paul there, if I recall right. Furthermore, many fathers and doctors of the church have seen the woman announced in the Proto-Evangelium as Mary, the mother of Christ, the new Eve. Then the Catechism goes on elsewhere. It says of the new Eve, for example, because she, quote, because she is the mother of the eternal Son of God made man, Jesus Christ, the new Adam. Mary is called the new Eve, the mother of the living in the order of grace, end of quote.
That's all through many of the fathers and early teachers of the church.
Yes. Regarding the new Adam, the Catechism says, quote, the church has learned that humanity was originally created in the state of holiness and justice, and that the first ancestors of the human race lost this state for themselves and all humanity by their sin, that is the original sin. And that's what we've been doing in the last several sessions, is taking a look at that matter.
Talked about original holiness,
yes,
and then the original sin.
Going back to the quote, Christ is called the second or new Adam, because he ushered in the new creation by forgiving sin and restoring humanity to the grace of God's friendship, lost by original sin. That ends that quote. The old Adam brings death to the world by eating from the tree of knowledge of the good and evil. And the new Adam, Jesus Christ, brings life into the world by the tree of the cross. That's a theme that you see in a lot of the church fathers, as you suggested a while ago. The old Adam succumbed to the temptation of Satan in the Garden of Eden. The new Adam, Jesus Christ, resists the temptations of Satan in the Garden of Gethsemane. Again, that's another theme that's pretty common with the church fathers. Nonetheless, the old Adam and his wife repented of their sin. God forgave them and made a new covenant with them. And they were saved by the merits of Jesus Christ applied retroactively. In other words, Christ living outside God, being the second person of the Trinity, living outside of time and space, all-powerful, all-knowing, he can actually do anything. And so, although Adam and Eve lived perhaps 100,000 years before Christ, we really don't know how long, but it certainly was a long time, Christ could suffer and die on the cross and merit, of course, all the grace necessary for salvation long, long after Adam and Eve, but he could apply the merits of his suffering and death to Adam and Eve and to every other human being that lived from Adam down to his own time.
Okay, but now are you saying, Ron, that then before Jesus came and died on the cross, grace was restored to Adam and Eve?
Oh, yes. Sanctifying grace was restored to Adam and Eve as soon as they repented and were sorry. But the grace that was earned was grace that the grace that was given to Adam and Eve was the grace that Christ was to earn 100,000 years later, which he applies retroactively to Adam and to all other human beings from the time of Adam. Because you see, the doors of heaven were closed until Christ came to redeem humankind many, many millennia later.
Well, Ron, this brings us to a completion of the discussion of the creation of the universe, the fall of humankind, or the sin of Adam and Eve, or the original sin. Can we summarize the main Catholic teachings now to be derived from these events in the Old Testament that we've talked about?
Father John Hardin, whom we have quoted many times in our various series, he was, up until his death in the year 2000, was one of the greatest catechists and theologians in the Catholic Church. And he's done a great job outlining the main Catholic teachings to be derived from the first three chapters of the book of Genesis. In an article entitled, God the Author of Nature and the Supernatural, a systematic treatise on God, man, and the universe. Not only in this article, not only does he identify the main teachings, but also he provides the source of these teachings as found in the Bible, the church fathers, and church documents that define them. He also identifies the main adversaries or critics of these teachings and refutes them. But for the sake of simplicity, he outlines the main teachings in 10 theses. And since it would require an entire series of itself or in itself to consider the sources, I'll list only the theses with very little commentary except for the first one.
Okay, so from Father John Hardin, one of our great Catholic outstanding theologians, who's deceased now, unfortunately.
And his calls for canonization, of course, has been...
Really?
Yes.
Forgot about that.
I'm not sure how far along it is, but it's. I know it's moving along. I think, lived in Louisville, just south of us here, about 120 miles.
Well, I know he did tremendous writing and tremendous defense of the church during these very difficult times.
Yes, certainly.
So he's going back to the first three chapters of the book of Genesis to get these fundamental teachings that the church clearly teaches us now. So but we're only going to talk about one.
Well, I'll mention the others, but the only one we're going to say much about is the first one. And the first one is that God alone created the world in time and with perfect freedom. Father Hardin goes through and defines these terms in that particular little comment there. For example, he defines creation in accordance with the Second Vatican Council as the production of material and spiritual things in their whole substance, done by God out of nothing, end of quote. We came across this the other day when we were talking about the creation, that God created the universe out of absolutely nothing. There was nothing that existed before that.
Cain, that's the awesomeness of what it means to create.
Yes.
Out of nothing, ex nihilo.
Ex nihilo, yes. There is a concept of secondary creation where once God sets the laws of nature and gets everything going, he doesn't necessarily step in every precise thing that happens, but it still is happening in accordance with what he set up and got in motion. And it's also a part of his plan, a part of his divine providence. Then he says that the world, and now he's going to define that, it's synonymous with the universe and includes the whole complexes of reality, material and spiritual, terrestrial and celestial, which exist outside of God. And then following this, he states that in time, that's another term in the little statement, remember the statement was God alone created the world in time and with perfect freedom. So now he's explaining here in time the meaning of that. And in time, the world did not exist from all eternity, or the world began in time. In other words, the minute the creation, God created, that's when time, that's when the clock started ticking.
All right.
Prior to that, there was no time. It's hard for us to conceive of that because, you know, there was no time or space. And so when he creates space and he creates time. Finally, he describes with perfect freedom. What does that mean to say that God created the universe with perfect freedom? And he says how utterly contingent the world is with relation to divine liberty. Contingent means, of course, dependent, just a big word for dependent. Consequently, the existence of the world depends only on the will of God, in the sense that, and he gives three different things here. One, there is no internal exigency, or another word for that is urgency.
Or necessity,
arising from the nature of God, or one of his attributes, which requires him to create. God does not required to create anything.
Okay.
What he's doing, he's anticipating here a lot of false teachings.
Okay.
And obviously we can't go into all those. He does this in the article. Number two, there's no need for God to create, as though he would have been less perfect had he not created. And three, God was not only free to create or not, but he was also free to create this or any other world had he so chosen. In other words, God is so powerful, he's so all-knowing, that he knew all of the other possible worlds he could have created instead of this one. And that number could have been millions.
Okay.
Of possible worlds that he could have created than the one he actually did create.
Staggering.
Yes, it is. It's really, really awesome.
Well, what's the list of other Father Hardin's thesis that he gets from these first three chapters of the book of Genesis that are clear Catholic teaching now based on the first three chapters?
Well, the second thesis that he says that derives from the first three chapters, God keeps the world in existence positively, directly and immediately. In other words, once God designed and created the universe, then he keeps it going. And if he didn't keep it going, it would cease to exist. If it weren't always a part of his mind, if for some reason, for example, he forgot any particular person, they'd be gone.
All right. So he holds everything he created in existence, in a sense like the light is held in existence by the flowing of electricity, and if you turn the electricity off, the light goes out.
Right.
And if God stopped continuing to hold you, me, the world, everything in existence, it would go back to nothingness?
Yeah, one way I heard it said that if God stopped thinking about anything, it would stop existing or stop being. Now, of course, God isn't going to do that. That's not in God's nature to do that.
Okay.
But that's another, of course, theological issue. Thesis 3, God's ultimate purpose is, in creating is his own goodness, to manifest his perfections through the benefits he bestows on creatures, not to increase his happiness, nor to acquire any perfection. In other words, if God is perfect, then there's nothing he can do to become more happy or more powerful or more anything.
Okay.
God created everything out of his goodness and the desire to communicate his glory and those kinds of things, to share his love with us and things like that. He created out of an abundance, not out of a deficiency, not out of a lack of something.
Okay, I think it's a philosophical principle we learned that goodness tends to be diffusive. It wants to share. It wants to, love wants to go out of its very nature, like the sun has to shine. That's of its very nature. Okay.
Well, he goes on to say, the ultimate purpose of the created world is this same divine goodness, primarily to be manifested in giving glory to God, and secondarily, to be participated by creatures for their benefit. In other words, everything we should do should be for the glory of God and for the benefit of humankind in some way.
All right, so could we summarize that by saying God, and think about this because I'm not sure I'm saying this correctly. God created not for his benefit, but for the benefit of we, all of us creatures.
Well, that's certainly a good way to put it.
All right.
Well, the fourth thesis, there exist angels who are pure spirits, of whom some persevered in grace and entered heaven, while others sinned and were damned. The good angels are sent to us as guardians, but demons tempt us men to sin as they roam about the world, of course, like a lion or whatever. I think St. Paul makes
it. Like a roaring lion, whom he may devour, Satan.
Yes.
St. Peter.
And we talked a little bit about the creation of the angels the other day. All these things we've actually talked about. So now we're trying to find out what kind of teachings were derived from them.
From these first three chapters of Genesis.
Yes, yes. Okay. Thesis, the fifth thesis, is in man there is one rational soul, which is immortal and immediately created by God alone. And we talked a little bit about how, you know, human beings are created in God's image and likeness, and in the image they're created like God in the sense is they're a spiritual being with an intellect and with a will, you know, puny compared to God.
Can know and love.
Sure.
Okay.
In other words, human beings can do the things that God can do, but at a much, much, much infinitely, you know, lesser level.
Sure.
The sixth thesis, the body of Adam was made by an immediate operation of God. That's an interesting one, and it would take some time to explain exactly, because the theory of evolution and things like that would get involved in dealing with that particular one. The seventh thesis, Adam was an individual man from whom the whole human race derives its origin. There's a theory called polygenism, where there was more than one pair of human beings. And so this is what Father's trying to offset with that.
It was very popular back in when I was teaching at Schulte in the early 50s. And I think it's certainly the church is really clear about we need to go back to one pair, Adam and Eve.
Well, and that's one of the points that Pius XII dealt with in Humani Generis, his great encyclical in 1950, where he was trying to refute a lot of doctrines that were floating around back during that time that were, you know, adversely affecting people's faith. Then we go on to the eighth thesis. Before the fall, Adam possessed sanctifying grace and the preternatural gifts of integrity, immortality, and infused knowledge. We looked at all three or four of these things, and we were talking about the creation of man. At the ninth thesis, Adam lost original justice, and I might add holiness, which he doesn't have here, by sinning gravely. Original sin, therefore, exists in all men as a true sin, proper in each individual person, and transmitted by Adam by propagation. We looked at that one as well.
Right, propagation rather than, and there was a theory around for a while, but it's by imitation,
mm-hmm.
but that it's passed down through the bloodline.
Yes.
Cain.
And then the last thesis, the tenth thesis, original sin essentially consists in the privation of sanctifying grace, that is, the loss of sanctifying grace. It is a voluntary in all men through their juridical solidarity under Adam, the physical and juridical head of the human race. The New England Puritans had in their horn book, the horn book was a like a little catechism that the Puritans had in the United States,
okay.
At least in the early colonial period in Massachusetts Bay and Plymouth Plantation and places like that. And A was A for Adam. And when Adam sinned, A was, when Adam sinned, we sinned all. Which, of course, obviously is a way of learning the alphabet, but at the same time learning a religious idea.
Well, say that again. I wasn't following.
When Adam sinned, we sinned all.
And that's
all of us sinned, in other words.
Okay, so it's A, the A business.
Yes.
Okay.
And then you go on to B and then to C.
Okay.
And whatever, all the way down through the alphabet, there was a little religious saying.
Okay, clever.
Sort of a little mnemonic device that
sure.
Did two things, helped you learn the alphabet at the same time, learn a little religion along with it. We kind of try to do that a little bit at John Paul, of course, in our various classes.
Right. Now, let me just say, when you say it is voluntary in all men, that means that it's in all men, but we personally didn't, it's not a personal sin, it's an inherited sin.
Yes, and that's what propagation means.
Okay.
Imitation would just simply mean that Adam and Eve set a bad example for all of us.
Right.
But we really didn't inherit genetically or biologically or whatever.
Spiritually.
Spiritually, mainly, his the stain of his sin.
Okay.
And as I preface this discussion about Father Hardin's thesis regarding the teachings to be derived from the first three chapters of the book of Genesis, not only does he identify the main teachings found in the first three chapters of Genesis, but also he provides the sources of these teachings as found in the Bible, the church fathers, and church documents that define them. And then he goes on in some detail to identify the main adversaries or critics of these teachings and refutes them. These are the main critics of each of these doctrines over, you know, a 2,000-year period.
Okay, so we're not going in detail into these other nine.
No, that would take a whole
sure.
That would series. Take a series in itself to do that.
Okay, well, having looked at those 10 doctrines that Father Hardin finds in the first three chapters of Genesis, are there any other doctrines found in the first three chapters that we might just mention?
Yes, I believe there is, or there are. For example, the fathers of the church saw a foreshadowing of the Trinity in God's statement in Genesis. Quote, let us make man in our image, in the likeness of ourselves. This is found in Genesis 1:26. The our and the ourselves refer to more than one person making up the Godhead. That's implicit, and that's as far as the Old Testament goes in identifying, you know, God as being consisting of three persons.
So it's kind of a foreshadowing, an adumbration, a indication. If we know about the Trinity, we can look back and say, well, gee, that our image and likeness of ourselves, that seems to be some kind of preparation for us.
And there's probably a dozen or more other places in the Bible, I've got a list somewhere, implicitly shows us that, you know, that God is, or points to at least, signifies
sure.
that God is a Trinity. But for the most part, you know, the Hebrews, the Jews, the Israelites never believed, of course, that God was
right.
more than,
well,
than one person.
They were absolute on God is one.
And usually thought of God as a father.
Okay.
There's quite a bit in the Old Testament.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. So the Trinity only came to us with the New Testament and Jesus talking about the Father and the Son and he who sees me sees the Father, etc. Okay.
Well, furthermore, we find the doctrines that deal with humans from an anthropological sense in God's image and likeness in Genesis 1 through 3 as well. And we went into that in quite a bit of detail. What does it mean to say that humans are created in God's image and God's likeness? And finally, the one we discussed a little earlier in this session, the doctrine of the proto-evangelium, or the first gospel, found in Genesis 3:15, which refers to the covenant made with Adam and Eve in regard to the Messiah, who would one day save humankind from the slavery of sin. And that's found in, of course, the first three chapters. And in closing this discussion, or at least beginning to kind of round it up anyway, all the teachings of the church are found either explicitly or at least implicitly somewhere in the Bible.
Now, you're not saying in the Old Testament.
Well, including the Old Testament.
But all the teachings of the church are found somewhere implicitly or explicitly in the Old Testament?
No, the whole Bible as a whole.
Okay, sure.
But really, the groundwork is being laid, as you can see, back in the first three chapters of Genesis.
Okay.
I've never made an intense study of this, and I imagine some theologians and biblical scholars have written on this subject, but I haven't come across it yet anyway, probably the great majority of church teachings originally flow out of the first three chapters that deal with the creation and the fall and the beginning of, the redemption.
Okay, so but certainly just in embryo.
Certainly in embryo
certainly
form,
like the Messiah and the redemption and the like. Okay, our time is almost running out. Summarize what we've said about the covenant, because that seems to be the key of the Old Testament.
Well, that's what testament means. The word testament equals covenant. Covenant equals testament.
Agreement between God and a person are persons are groups of people.
It's a sacred agreement, and there were, in the Old Testament, scripture scholars have identified five. The first one is the proto-evangelium that we mentioned today.
With
Adam and Eve. God really makes this because Adam's representing the whole human race. But also, looking at it from another perspective, he's making this agreement with a pair, with a couple.
Okay.
Then he makes an agreement with Noah, and of course that includes his family, and then he makes it with Abraham and his tribe.
Isaac and Jacob.
And then he renews it with Isaac and Jacob, his son and grandson. And then finally, of course, with David. And of course, there he's making an agreement with the with a nation or with an empire. And then, of course, the final covenant is the new and everlasting covenant of the New Testament that Jesus makes, of course, on our behalf for the whole human race.
Okay, and the Last Supper, he talks about this is the new covenant in my blood. Well, Ron, thanks. Our time is running out. To our listening audience, we say, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.